Thank you all for coming. Many of you know Irene Zhang. She is a PhD student about to graduate from the University of Washington across the lake, where she works on large-scale distributed systems, advised by Hank Levy and Arvind Krishnamurthy. Or maybe more accurately than saying she's advised by them, she's almost like a colleague to them. She came to them after having cut her teeth at VMware in the Virtual Machine Monitor group for 3 years, after getting her master's at MIT with Franz Kosek. She's had, so given that, given the time that she spent, she, even though it's been a fairly, even though she hasn't graduated yet, she's amassed a stellar research career. She's got five OSDI and SOSP papers, three of which have her as first author. It's very impressive. So I'm glad she's here, and I hope you'll all join me in welcoming Irene.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, so thanks for the introduction, Jay. I am actually going to try to get through three papers today, so you guys will have to bear with me. And do feel free to interrupt me if you want more details about things, because I am going to go very, very fast. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about work that I've done on trying to help applications that run across mobile devices and cloud servers deal with some of their design challenges. So you guys might have noticed that in the last 5 or 10 years, the devices that you interact with on a daily basis are really different. I see someone on their phone right now. And so, we've really moved away from desktop computers into this world where cloud services and mobile devices are really pervasive. And this change is actually a lot more fundamental than you might think. It's a lot deeper than the change that happened when we moved from mainframes to desktop PCs, because we're moving from a long era of monolithic centralized computing platforms to ones that are distributed. And that means that the applications that users use today don't run on a single device anymore. They span lots of cloud servers and lots of mobile devices. These are some of the popular applications today, but there are also really important applications that run on mobile devices and cloud servers, as well as some things that, we really would think of as desktop applications. They're really becoming distributed as well. Back to centralized applications, what we did with those applications was they relied heavily on operating systems to help them with a lot of design challenges. So programmers had to figure out in, way back in the day, how to run more than one application on a single device. And researchers kind of developed processes as an abstraction for that. They also had to figure out how to share data and coordinate across those processes. And we developed IPC, or inter-process communication, for that. And then they also had to figure out how to persistently store user data for long periods. And we developed file systems in response. So all of these things work together to really help application programmers with a lot of those problems that they started out having to solve. When we move on to look at modern applications that span mobile devices and cloud servers, they have a completely different set of challenges. Instead of trying to figure out how to deploy a single application or multiple applications on a single device, they need to figure out how to deploy a single application on lots of devices. They also need to figure out how to coordinate across processes that are widely distributed, and they need to figure out how to store exceedingly large amounts of user data. And all of this means that existing systems don't really meet their needs, and so we're back to this state where application programmers are out there dealing with these problems and kind of coming up with ad hoc solutions. And so what my research recently has been on is trying to figure out how to develop systems to help programmers cope with these kinds of challenges. So in this talk, like I said, I'm going to try to cover three systems very quickly. These three systems I designed in response to those three challenges that you saw on the last slide. But I also wanted them to have those classic operating systems properties that you might expect. I want them to be general purpose, easy to use, and efficient. But looking at a broader picture, this is just three systems. I won't say that this is, these systems solve are the only solution to all of those design challenges that I put up on the last slide. And I won't even say that those design challenges are really even the end-all, be-all to all of the problems that modern applications face. But what I want you to think about instead is that these three systems are a first step towards providing better system support for mobile cloud applications. So this is an outline of my talk. I'm just going to go through each of the systems and talk about how we tried to tackle these design challenges for applications, and what kind of solution we came up with. So the first one I'm going to talk about is Sapphire, which is a system that's designed to help programmers deploy their application on multiple devices and servers. So as an example, throughout my talk, I'm going to use this mobile cloud game. It's a multiplayer game called The 100 Game. I don't know how many people have heard of The 100 Game. OK, it's exceedingly simple. And as a result, it's used a lot of times for a beginning programmer exercise in lots of intro classes. And so the way it works is it's just a multiplayer game where the users take turns round robin. On each turn, the user enters a number between 1 and 10, which is then added to this shared sum. And then the first user to reach 100 wins. So super simple game, right? So the reason I chose this application, the thing that's interesting about it is that the game logic is exceedingly simple, right? I mean, any beginning programmer should be able to write this application. But what happens is that when we want to write this application to span mobile devices and cloud servers, it's not that easy. In particular, it's not that easy because we want to implement this game logic, but we also need a bunch of distributed systems properties. So we're going to want to also implement things like availability, fault tolerance, persistence, scalability, and consistency, right? And these are the things that make building this application hard, not the complexity of the application itself. Okay, so if I were a programmer who was just starting out trying to build this application, the first thing that I would need to do is try to figure out how to split my application up into components and achieve these properties, okay? And the reason that that's hard is because the way that I choose to deploy my application across mobile devices and cloud servers forces me to make a trade-off between these application properties and other things like performance and how complex my application is going to be. And so, you know, starting out, I might just try to do the simplest thing, right, which is just run the application on one user's device and have the other user send all of their moves that way. Or maybe to be a little bit more fair, I might run the application on both users' devices and then synchronize in between. I might want persistence on top of that, so maybe I'll add a disk on one of the devices or even both of them for better fault tolerance too. Now, I might want slightly better availability so that if one of the users walks off, the other user can still make his move. So maybe I'll add a cloud server. Maybe I'll replicate that cloud server for fault tolerance or add some sort of distributed storage system for persistence. Maybe I'll add a couple of more front-end servers for scalability, right? So there are just so many options here. These are just a couple of the ways that you could, you know, imagine. I'm sure you can come up with lots of other ways that you could deploy this application. And the reason this problem is really hard is because there's a lot of heterogeneity in this environment. The capabilities and processing ability of the different devices and servers are really different. Their availability properties are really different. The latency of different network connections and how likely those network connections are to go away. All of these things impact the trade-offs that have to be made between these distributed systems properties that the programmer might want to achieve and things like performance and complexity. And so that means what happens in the end is the programmer really has to make a decision. And it has to be based on the things that, you know, the application wants to do. And so that means building a general purpose system to deploy a mobile cloud application is actually really hard, which is probably why, you know, it's not something that you really see. But that's the problem we chose to tackle first. We want to build a system that's actually able to deploy applications in different ways and meet the needs and allow programmers to control trade-offs. And so Sapphire is that system. We I'll show you how it works in a minute, but Sapphire basically just takes your application and automatically deploys it across mobile devices and cloud servers. The programmer still gets to choose exactly what kind of deployment they want, and Sapphire essentially will create a customized runtime system for your application. So all of this flexibility is enabled by a unique three-layer architecture. At the top is an application, which the programmer divides into a number of Sapphire objects. These are units of deployment, so you can really think of them as distributed processes. They encapsulate data, they can be called from anywhere, they can move transparent to the application. Then at the bottom of this architecture, we have the deployment kernel, or kernel, which we call it for short. And the kernel provides these basic best effort services for Sapphire objects. The kernel creates them, migrates them, and it does best effort RPC. So there are no trade-offs to anything that the kernel does, because it's only trying to do things best effort. And then in the middle, we have a number of modules, which we call deployment managers. And these extend the deployment kernel with additional guarantees and properties for a single Sapphire object. And so a simple deployment manager might just add at least once RPC on top of best effort RPC, right? And all it does is just retry. But then we have more complex things like, we could checkpoint an entire Sapphire object disk every time it receives an RPC. The other nice thing about these deployment managers is that they're really easy to change. With a single line of code, the programmer could decide that maybe they want to do primary backup replication instead of checkpointing to disk for better availability. Or maybe they want some sort of Paxos consensus protocol instead. And these deployment managers encapsulate all of those things. So we built a library of deployment managers, but actually application programmers can also get in there and muck around with the deployment managers themselves if they want to. But the key thing to get away from this slide is that there's a really wide variety of them. They do a lot of things. And when you put them together with Sapphire objects, the programmer is actually able to easily create a distributed runtime system, a deployment for their application that's completely customized for the needs of their application. And to give you some idea of how this works, we're going to go back to our game. And I'll show you the performance in terms of latency for a couple of different deployments of that multiplayer game. So as I said, the first thing I might do is just run one of my run the game on one user's device. And as we can see, obviously, it's not all that fair. The first user gets really good performance, and the other user gets kind of crappy performance. So then maybe we'll just replicate our game across the two users' devices and then synchronize. In any other sort of application, doing this would be really difficult. You'd have to write a lot of code, deal with the replication, try to figure out how to synchronize. But in Sapphire, we're able to do this with a single line of code. And that's because you can just change deployment deployment managers, where someone has implemented this deployment for you already, and you're able to reuse them from application to application. And since that was so easy, maybe I'll just run another test to see how my game performs using a cloud server. And so the key takeaway from this slide is that these deployments actually have really different performance characteristics, and you'd want to pick based on, how often the users in your game might make a move, or if player one does most of the gameplay. So these trade-offs are really dependent on the application logic, but it's very easy to move from one deployment to another so that you can easily test what the impact of these different deployments on your game are. The other thing is we started out with some essentially a client-side-only application, and then we moved to a server-side-based application. In today's applications, that would be really, really hard to do. Nobody would go around testing all three of these options because it's just too much work. And so everyone just makes these decisions a priori because there's no easy way to go and take a look at these different deployment options and their performance. Okay, so now that I've talked about how we're going to help programmers deploy their application across multiple devices, let's talk about how we're actually then going to coordinate across those devices. Sure.
I just have a high-level question. So sure. You talked about just take the game as an example, right? If I'm a mobile game developer, at least one of my primary concerns is going to be battery life on the mobile game, how much network bandwidth this consumes. Mm-hmm. So the three decisions that you showed, they're not independent. It's not like the programmer has a chance, right? And it's like Sapphire doesn't do anything in terms of battery life. I didn't see that as a knob anywhere, nor did I see it as a service. It doesn't do anything in terms of minimizing bandwidth. That decision and that entire logic is still up to me. So I'm not quite sure why you picked game development as an example for Sapphire. Something else?
So yeah, we've implemented lots of other applications, you know, Twitter, like a Twitter clone kind of thing. What else? Like a to-do list manager. I think maybe the way to think about it is that Sapphire is a mechanism that enables this flexibility. Then on top of that, you know, one of the things that you could imagine doing is building some sort of system that figures out what is the best deployment manager for your application. Sapphire doesn't go about doing that, right? You're very correct. Sapphire just leaves that decision up to the application programmer, assuming that they know what the best thing to do is. And maybe they don't, you know. It's not easy to make these choices. But that's not the particular problem that we're solving in Sapphire. Our goal in Sapphire is flexibility, so that if you did, you know, want to change those decisions or test them, it becomes very easy.
I can go. You're still making these decisions a priori, though, right? I can't deploy, have users, and then change it in between.
No, you would have to release a new version of your software. Yeah.
Which means I have to move the state over, and I have to take care of all that, right?
No, I mean, it's just the code.
State on my local device, and I'm moving my state to the cloud, you're deploying.
Oh, sure, yeah. The point is that, you know, these applications develop very rapidly. You're always getting updates. So, you start out with something that you hope is good after you've run a sequence of experiments, right? Because that's pretty much the best you can do. You don't actually know in the real world what's going to happen, right? And so the point, again, is that you have the flexibility to run those experiments, which today you just wouldn't.
Sure.
And afterwards, you know, after a month, 2 months, a year, whatever, you can change those decisions.
See, that's where I have a problem. Like, if you change the decision, state is a huge problem, right?
I mean, it depends on what kind of state you're talking about, right? So it could be very temporary state. So like for something like Twitter, right, it's just your latest tweets. And so if you change that decision, you just, you know, you're putting your latest tweet somewhere else. I mean, same for the game, right? Like, you're not going to keep playing that game through a version update of your software. Like, Sapphire is dealing with soft state. It's not necessarily dealing with really hard state, because you're really just caching things on your mobile device, you know, anyway, right? Like,
offline, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, just keep moving.
Yeah. Do you have an example where you need different configurations for different applications?
Yeah.
And if it is always that the cloud-based deployment is the optimal in some sense, then you
Yeah, no, no, that. Definitely not. Yeah, so, I mean, you should take a look at the paper. We also have things like, so to give you another example, we've built things like code offloading. And so the code offloading deployment manager is really interesting, because what it causes people to do is take a look at their application and say, this chunk of code does a lot of computation, but it's pretty state-free. And so I'm gonna use a code offloading deployment manager with it. And so, like, even within a single application, right, you often have lots of deployment managers that you're using. Okay.
The kind of plugins you're describing are pretty close to the runtime and normally very sensitive to performance issues. What did you do that made it so simple to plug these things in and claim, it sounds like from the numbers that you're claiming they have, the plugin architecture doesn't have much of an effect on the performance of the runtime apart from the choice of deployment manager?
Yeah, because the way that the deployment managers work is through interposition. So like a Sapphire object receives an RPC, will run a little bit of code in the deployment manager, and then usually shoot the RPC up to the Sapphire object. And so the deployment managers, obviously like a replication deployment manager would have overhead, right? Because it needs to coordinate with the other replicas. And so there is overhead there's cost to each deployment manager. But the kernel itself is basically just directing traffic.
So it's just, so this is running at application level? This is not?
It's a Java library.
Sorry?
It's a Java library.
And so you're basically doing interception of message calls, basically.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And doing everything in there.
Yep.
So did you run into mechanisms that you wanted to add that really didn't lend themselves to that interception architecture? Because you know it's only through messaging. I mean, there are many things you want to do to have extensibility.
Well, one of the things we had a hard time doing was things across Sapphire objects. If you wanted to run a distributed transaction that encompassed several Sapphire objects, that was basically impossible to coordinate. So these runtime systems are pretty much limited to managing a single process, essentially, a single Sapphire object. Yeah. But let me move on to Diamond, too, because Diamond, I think, in some ways solves some of these problems of coordination across processes, because that's what it's designed to do. Okay, so I talked about a couple of distributed systems properties for the Sapphire section of this talk. And next, I'm going to introduce a new distributed systems property that mobile cloud applications increasingly have. And the reason it's important is because this property significantly increases the amount of data sharing and coordination that these mobile cloud applications have had to do over the last couple of years. So the new property is called reactivity. It's essentially similar to reactive programming. So when a user makes an update, they expect that update to automatically propagate across the entire application. So for my game, the example would be I make a move. I'm not going to hit save or reload or anything. I just want my opponent to automatically see that move. So the obvious example of reactivity that you've probably seen, which is very specialized, but is Google Docs or any sort of text editing application that's collaborative. But it's also gotten very popular with social networks. So you might have noticed, this is really the last 5 years or so. Facebook and Twitter have gotten very reactive. You don't reload anymore. You just like something and it shows up on the other person's device. It's also, has been pretty common for mobile games. So things like Words with Friends. I think that's been common for a while. And then collaboration tools like Trello, very popular. Where if you move something between lists, it'll just automatically move. There's no save button. And then your collaborators will see it. Now, to give you some idea of why this is really hard to achieve inside a mobile cloud application, I'm going to talk about how we might be able to build a reactive version of the 100 game. So in terms of deployment, I'll start out just really simple, two clients, and then I'll use a shared cloud store. And I'll use the shared cloud store to hold data and also provide some of those important properties like persistence and consistency and fault tolerance. So this means that if I make a move on my mobile device over here to the left, my application client is going to update its own state locally. But then it also needs to write that update to the cloud store, right? Now I've updated essentially the entity that holds our shared data, but that's not actually even close to being enough to achieve reactivity, right? Because you might have noticed that my opponent actually hasn't seen anything. They don't have any idea that something has changed. And so in order to tell them that they need to reload, I'm going to introduce a notification service. And so this write to the cloud store is now just the first step. We're also going to notify the client, my opponent's client, and let them know that they need to go and read an update from the cloud store and then update the UI for the other user. Okay? So altogether, maybe this doesn't seem so complicated. But remember, we're in a distributed environment where things can fail and messages can get lost. And so if this happens, even if I rejoin the game on a new device, my opponent is still going to think it's my move, and I'm going to think it's my opponent's move, and we'll be stuck playing this game forever, right? So this is no good. I've not actually achieved those properties that I wanted. And so, okay, we're, a lot of us are distributed systems people here. We'll just write to a log and hope that works. Well, that's not all that great either, because, you know, maybe I dropped my phone in a sewer, or, you know, maybe I haven't come back online. I still want my opponent to know it's their turn so they can start thinking about the move they want to make. Okay, so that's not so great. Maybe for better availability, I'll add a cloud server and then send the move over to the cloud server. Okay, well, Sapphire will let us do that pretty easily, but this cloud server could fail too, right? It doesn't actually, you know, it can't follow in a sewer, but we haven't actually solved this problem. So, okay, maybe we'll log to the cloud store. Now this is, you know, we're going to be sure that that's persistent. And now we can actually notify the other client. Okay, my opponent's phone might crash before it's able to process this notification. So we'd probably better log it over there, too, just to be safe. And then now, finally, maybe we can go and read that update from the cloud store and update my opponent's UI. So I'm not actually sure if this completely solves the problem. But what you can get out of this is that a lot of this reasoning that I've just gone through, it's things that distributed systems designers do. You know, it's things that people who design distributed protocols think about. What happens if this fails? What happens if this message gets reordered? They're not things that application programmers should ever have to deal with, right? And what we discovered when looking at these applications is just that when you have shared data that you want to be reactive, right now, applications are doing a huge amount of complex distributed coordination in order to make that happen. So to tackle this problem, we built a system called Diamond. Like a storage system, Diamond ensures that your updates are persistent and consistent. It also coordinates and synchronizes with storage systems on the mobile devices. But as well, it automatically triggers application code when shared data changes. And so altogether, this gets you end-to-end reactivity from one mobile device all the way to another in a way that's fault-tolerant and available with all of those nice properties, distributed systems properties that we might want.
Mm-hmm. The worldview that you showed in the previous slide, that's a straw man, right?
Yes.
If you look at some of the popular solutions that people use today to solve some of these problems, mm-hmm. Around 2011 or so, Firebase was one of these startups, right? That was really hot, and then Google acquired them for this precise reason, right? Mm-hmm. Because app developers were facing this problem mm-hmm. that you described here. I guess what's the, where does that fall short?
Yeah. So the way to think about it is that we want Firebase, but with strong guarantees. So we're going to give people transactions, and we're going to give them strong end-to-end guarantees. So you're not just going to get a notification. We're actually going to ensure that the notification gets processed. It is pushed all the way to the UI. So maybe the way to think about it is it's like Firebase, but strongly integrated with something like ReactiveX or, you know, the reactive UI frameworks. And it's actually, we're going to give them systems guarantees, you know, that if you make a write over here, we're going to guarantee that the UI on your opponent's device is going to change. And you don't have to try to glue the two together. And so I'll show you the programming model, and I think that'll make things more clear. So the Diamond programming model has four concepts, and I'm going to go through them one at a time. And then down at the bottom here, I've drawn an example of my 100 game that I'm going to populate so that you can understand how these programming concepts work together to get you that really strong end-to-end guarantee. So the first abstraction that I'm going to introduce is reactive data types, or RDTs. These are essentially shared data structures, but they're also persistent and distributed. RDTs can be something simple like a string. They can also be collections like lists. We also have conflict-free replicated data types for the consistency nerds out there. We have CRDTs for performance reasons. So we have things like a counter with increment operations that can commute. We chose these RDTs partially inspired by data structure stores like Redis. Because the data structures are general enough that lots of applications can use them, but they have the semantics we need to get better performance. So we don't want to use like a page for shared data or a single object, right? Because that doesn't have any semantics. So RDTs are really easy to use. We provide programmers with a libdiamond library, and you just instantiate RDTs out of that. So we might create a list to hold our players, a counter to hold our sum, and then a shared string to hold whose turn it is. Okay, pretty simple. So now that we have RDTs, we need to link them into Diamond so Diamond can manage those RDTs for us. And the way we do that is with something called Reactive Data Map, or RMAP. So RMAP is really important because it's an abstraction for programmers to create distributed shared memory that's very flexible. For people who remember distributed shared memory, it's not exactly what we want here, but we kind of want some of the same properties, right? And in particular, what we want is that we might have clients that have different address spaces, so we want clients to be able to control their address spaces. And clients probably don't want all of their data shared, right? So this also allows programmers to pick what gets shared. RMAP is pretty simple to use, too. You just pick an RDT and then link it to a key in the Diamond key value store using RMAP. And so we might link all of our shared variables to corresponding keys. Okay. And now once everything is mapped, Diamond will ensure that if you write to an RMAPed RDT in one client, the updates are propagated with strong guarantees to the Diamond backing store and everyone else who has the same RMAPed key. Okay, so let's talk about how to write to those RMAPed RDTs now that we've linked them in. We provide read-write transactions. These execute application code and can read or write to shared RDTs. These read-write transactions are important because we want programmers to be able to control isolation and atomicity, right? Because other people might be writing to those shared RDTs at the same time, and you might crash in the middle of a series of updates to shared RDTs, right? And you don't want to leave the system in some sort of weird, inconsistent state. So if I wanted to initialize the RDTs that I created and RMAPed, I'd just begin a transaction and then set the list of players to be just myself to start with, start the sum at 0, and then set it to be my turn, okay? So now when I commit this transaction, Diamond will group together those updates and ship them to the Diamond store in an atomic unit, okay? Okay, so now that we've seen how to update RDTs, let's talk about how we actually get that strong end-to-end guarantee. So we introduce something called a reactive transaction. This transaction executes application code, but it's only allowed to read shared RDTs. And so reactive transactions are essentially our key abstraction for ensuring that the application fault tolerantly even processes the shared update and redraws the UI or propagates those updates to other state, whatever it needs to do. So the way that you use an RDT is at the beginning of your application, when it starts, you register the reactive transaction by passing it an application function that reads a couple of shared RDTs. Then every time these shared RDTs change, we'll take the function, wrap it in a transaction, and run that transaction. So we might redraw the UI for you or whatever else you might need to do when shared data changes. Okay, so now you've seen all four of the concepts. Mm-hmm.
But you don't need a notification in the previous slide.
There's no notification.
So you have a constant communication between the device and the cloud.
No, there's notification in Diamond, but the application programmer doesn't see it.
Yeah, but there's
notifications. There's notifications, yeah. Yeah. So
would it be correct to interpret that programming model as a materialized view that's being updated in the middle tier every time the database changes?
Yes, it's materialized in the client.
Well, I mean, materialized views are often materialized in the middle tier and client, whatever, client from the database's point of view.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.
Let's see. Okay, so now we've seen all four programming concepts, so let's put them together. So when I update my client over here on the left and make a move, then my application is going to write to a couple of shared RDTs. using a read-write transaction. So it's going to update the sum. It's going to update whose turn it is. Now, because my application has RMapped those RDTs into the key value store, that update's automatically going to get propagated across the key value store and my opponent's client, which also RMapped the same keys. So when my opponent's client gets that update, the reactive transaction that it registered at the beginning is going to be triggered to rerun, and it's going to automatically redraw the UI for my opponent. And so the important thing to note here is that there's no explicit communication for the application. There's no triggers that it needs to handle. Everything is happening completely transparently and under the covers. And so what we've done is we've taken all of this mucky distributed coordination and replaced it with what's essentially a shared memory model. It's shared distributed data structures and transactions that run on top. And so, you know, all it...
Any kind of complexity, if I have multiple receivers?
No, but we handle that. Yeah, there can. It's scalable. The idea is that you can have lots and lots of reactive transactions registered at your device or other people's devices.
I see.
So I'll show you in a minute.
Okay. Yeah. So the reactive transaction is just simply one-to-one. It's not a one-to-many?
You can make one update and trigger lots of reactive transactions.
I see. That's
yeah.
So again, you know, thinking from the viewpoint of the mobile game developer, right? Mm-hmm. Here, the key issue is, again, my battery.
Okay.
I have no control over how the diamond is holding the connection open and it is slow. The connection might be open for a long time. The connection might be coming and going. As a game developer, might want to prioritize either response time or battery life.
Mm-hmm.
Where are those hooks?
I mean, are there hooks like that today and things
yeah,
like Google Neuter notifications? I mean, I don't think necessarily like...
I could batch update, for example.
Okay, sure.
Right? Instead of getting, if there are going to be two updates back to back that are going to override an update,
mm-hmm.
If you want to save my battery life, you probably want to batch them and
okay.
turn off my connection from the other side.
Okay, well, you could put them in one transaction if you...
But I'm asking whether Diamond would do that automatically. Rather than me twice.
No, I meant the application programmer could put it in one transaction if they wanted to batch updates. I guess I'm not. Okay, yeah.
I have another thing that we should probably take offline, but I just thought it was funny to teach you things. The key issue is battery life. I was thinking the key issue here is security.
Yeah.
Motivating it with games, you may not trust the clients, right? A lot of these game implementations are worried
mm-hmm.
about cheap.
Yep,
and
yep.
stuff like that. And by putting these low-level primitives on the client side, it's much harder to say what valid operations can the client do next.
So the thing to note about Diamond is that it's actually a very general abstraction. The client here could also be a server. And so you could actually put a server in the middle to check whatever, you know, because all Diamond is doing is sharing data and coordinating, right? And so you could actually put a server in the middle with a reactive transaction that's designed to run and check whether the updates the client's making are valid. And that's sort of essentially how Firebase works.
Okay. I'll ask you about that.
Yes.
So also, I think there are like two different models here, and Sapphire is sort of more on one side, and this is a bit more on the other one. And I think the difference is that for something like Sapphire, you basically have the operations described as, you know, operations on an object or a service
mm-hmm.
that are maintained that way. And here what you're doing is you have sort of data structures that are declared by the program and then manipulated using transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are alternatives. And I was curious as to like why you chose one for the first project and then this one for this project. And you could all your implementation techniques would apply to either one of those worldviews.
Yeah, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the alternative ways that this could have been designed. So the way that I think about Sapphire is that you're treating the Sapphire objects or processes as black boxes. You don't look inside, right? And you move them around and you do things to them. Whereas Diamond is designed to then coordinate between those black boxes because they have to coordinate with each other. They could do it with messages, right? They can call each other. In Sapphire, you can call another Sapphire object.
It could be the reactivity with Sapphire too, right?
Well, Like I said, doing this reactivity requires peeking inside the application because you need to know when to coordinate and what data to synchronize. And so Sapphire doesn't do that. Is that okay?
Yeah, it could be done also with some extra effort, actually.
Yeah. Somebody asked about notifications. There's a pretty complicated protocol that coordinates all of this under the covers. And, you know, I guess the point here is that Diamond, the programming abstraction, wraps all of this and doesn't make it visible to the programmer because we get this correct. And there's a lot of coordination and there's timestamps and multi-versioning involved to make sure that we actually get the transactions consistent and all of your updates. You're getting them in increasing order and, you know, other kinds of guarantees like that. So we wrote lots of code. This runs on both x86 and ARM, so you can run it, you know, on your mobile device, on your server. And we came up with a new type of optimistic concurrency control that's designed to be to provide better performance for data types like our counter. So I'll talk about.
What's the correctness criterion?
So we have this thing called ACID plus R, and you can look at the paper. We're defining it kind of. It's defined similar to database guarantees, plus reactivity.
Is it reusable?
We actually for the isolation levels we have a range. You can choose. Everything from read committed to strict serializability, linearizable. So you actually get to choose.
There's a whole bunch of. There's a lot of debate over what.
Yes.
Kind of.
No, we have not done.
Is actually comprehensible.
Yeah.
You haven't really tried to innovate on that.
No.
You're just passing through one of the standard.
I think the thing that we did innovate on is that we're using CRDTs to reduce the abort rate for. Optimistic concurrency control. It's a little thing, but it does help performance a lot. Because you often have shared data structures that are very contended.
So what is it about the CRDTs that allows you to reduce aborts?
So if you have increment operations, normally that would be a read and then a write, and you wouldn't be able to do two of them concurrently. You'd have to abort.
That's just object property.
Yes, no, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, we're taking it, essentially we're optimizing the OCC using the object semantics.
Okay.
And I think the performance would just be terrible over the wide area if you didn't have object semantics.
Okay, so object semantics.
Yeah, object semantics. I'm going to talk about how we compared Diamond to a hand-coded implementation. And so what we did was we took a couple of applications that you might want to build on top of Diamond, and we implemented them both by hand and then on top of Diamond. And what we found was that, these applications ranged from pretty simple to pretty complex. For example, the Scrabble game is just something we pulled off the internet. It's not, we didn't implement this hand-coded implementation. What we also noticed was that the applications were not actually able to achieve all of the distributed systems properties they might want. In particular, not all of these applications are even reactive. And then what we did was we ported those applications to Diamond. And what you can see is that we were actually able to reduce the complexity. I know lines of code is not a great metric, but we tore out a lot of coordination and distributed communication. And then on top of that, we were able to achieve or provide for these applications all of the distributed systems properties that they might want. Overall, we found that Diamond simplifies the application and provides it with stronger guarantees because you're just getting all of this in a box, right? You just use Diamond and it handles stuff for you. So the question, of course, is what does it cost? And here I'm showing the throughput for the retwist transactional benchmark. It's something that we came up with based on retwist, which is an implementation of Twitter for Redis, which is a popular key value store. And I'm showing throughput in terms of transactions per second. So what we found is that Diamond provides throughput at about 2% of the hand-coded implementation using Redis. But if we look at Diamond versus Redis, Diamond is actually under the covers in the backend store running a view stamp replication, a Paxos protocol. And so it's actually providing better consistency than Redis at a lower cost. Then if we take a look at Diamond with its strongest isolation guarantee, Diamond provides about 50% the performance of Redis. And this is the overhead of coordinating linearizable transactions across the wide area. And so the thing to note here is that you're getting strong isolation, but it's coming at a cost. Okay, so now I talked about how to share data and coordinate across distributed processes for reactive mobile cloud applications. And I'm going to wrap up by talking about a system that we built to help programmers persistently store large amounts of data, which is called Taper. So the standard solution for how to store user data today is to use a distributed storage system, right? You pick up something like some cloud store, and it stores all of your data for you. Under the covers, the way that it's able to scale up to large amounts of data is that it's actually partitioning the data across many servers for scalability. And then it's probably also replicating the data for better fault tolerance, availability, and for persistence. Okay. So this is all fine, but of course our neat picture of a single cloud store is not actually the way the system underneath is going to work. It's actually taking all of your data and strewing it across multiple servers. For that reason, distributed transactions with strong guarantees like linearizability make these systems easier to use, because what they give you is, if you have two clients that are submitting transactions at the same time, the system will enforce that all of the servers run the gray transaction, then the blue transaction. Okay? But of course, this comes at some cost. These distributed transactional storage systems have to use a transaction protocol to coordinate across the partitions, and then they have to use a replication protocol to coordinate across the replicas in each partition. And all of this adds up to additional latency, as well as lower throughput. So in this work, what we observed was that programmers were having to choose between distributed transactions, which are easier to use, and better performance. But we decided that this choice was actually unnecessary, because what we saw was that these systems, these existing systems, are using two protocols that actually both enforce a strong ordering of transactions, and that actually wastes work and performance for the systems. Okay. So what we did in the Taper work was we built a linearizable transaction protocol on top of a replication protocol that doesn't enforce any ordering at all. So we're doing all of our ordering at the top level. So in the rest of the section, I'm going to talk about our unordered replication protocol first, and then I'll talk about Taper. So inconsistent replication, or IR, is what we call our unordered replication protocol. And it's designed in the same vein as things like view stamp replication or multi-Paxos or Raft. But it doesn't provide any ordering at all for operations. Instead, what it does is it provides, it gets the replicas to agree on and then persist the operation outcome, the result of the operation, that's then returned to the application. And here, when I say application, I'm talking about a distributed transaction protocol, the application protocol that's running on top of this replication protocol. Okay, so not an end user application. So IR provides three guarantees. The first one is probably pretty familiar, but the next two are a little bit weird, right? So I'm going to explain why these guarantees are important for allowing application protocols to detect and avoid conflicts so that we're actually able to provide a stronger guarantee in the application protocol than you're getting from the replication protocol. So the way this works is IR ensures that every transaction gets run at least at a majority. And so we have this blue transaction and this gray transaction. And the gray transaction might only run at the left two replicas, and the blue one might only run at the right two. But that replica in the middle is going to be able to detect if there are any conflicts between these two transactions. And then IR also ensures that the decision that the replicas make, that is to commit the blue transaction and abort the gray transaction, actually gets preserved across failures. Okay. So I'm going to go through very quickly how the protocol actually works. So the client first sends the operation to the replicas. The replicas return the result. And if a supermajority of the replicas actually send matching results, then we're able to return that result to the application, and then we're done. Okay? But of course, you can run operations where the replicas don't agree. In this case, the result gets returned back up to the application protocol, which chooses which of the results it wants to keep.
Mm-hmm. Why do you choose to re-execute the operations or triplets as opposed to just making one of them primary and then just pushing the change data down?
Because we don't have a primary.
Why is it easy?
Because the primary is a bottleneck in all of these distributed replication protocols. I mean, this doesn't require any.
This does require extra CPU cycles, right? Perhaps because if you're going with a sharded solution.
But the replicas aren't doing anything.
They're re-executing the transaction, aren't
they? I mean, yes, but they normally wouldn't be doing anything.
No, if you're going for a sharded architecture, they're probably primaries for someone else.
Okay, well, I'll say the bottleneck in these systems is in general not the CPU. It's how much processing, how many messages the leader can get in and out through the system, right? So what we're trying to gain here is both better latency and better throughput. But yeah, I guess maybe like you'd get worse energy or something. finish. So the result that the application protocol actually picks gets committed back to the replicas before we declare this operation to be done. Okay. So we can talk about how IR is faster. It is more efficient because it doesn't have to coordinate across the replicas at all during replication. But of course, it's less general. So you can't run state machine replication. You can't have an ordered log. None of these things work on top of IR. But of course, what we're expecting is not for IR to be used by general application programmers. We're expecting IR to be integrated into a system that then runs another protocol on top of it. So Taper is that protocol. Taper is designed specifically to work with IR, and it's able to enforce a linearizable transaction ordering on top of IR's weak guarantees. It uses two-phase commit for atomicity still, but then it uses IR for fault tolerance and availability and all of those things you get from replication. Okay. So the way Taper works with IR is the clients submit transactions to Taper. Then Taper replicates those transactions across the replicas using IR. Okay? And so the blue transaction here is touching data from two partitions, but the gray one is touching data from all three partitions. So as you can see, this protocol is faster. It's able to commit transactions in a single round trip. And we don't have any sort of bottleneck now. The leader in particular doesn't have to process two times the messages of the other replicas. So we're reducing the number of messages in general. Okay. But of course, as you can see, everything's not roses. This looks kind of like a mess. I mean, it's a mess. In particular, replicas in the same partition can miss transactions that other replicas see. Replicas might get transactions in different orders. And the replicas might have a partial history or partial transaction log. And it has to make the correct decisions in spite of all of this. Okay? So I'm going to talk about how Taper handles each of these problems in a bit of detail.
What assumptions are you making for the replication protocol itself? Do you assume to be running in a synchronous environment or asynchronous environment?
It doesn't provide liveness in the asynchronous. I mean, it's identical to Paxos, to multi-Paxos. The assumptions and not the guarantees, but. Mm-hmm.
So how are these, who's coordinating the transaction? So
nobody.
How are these partitions, what does it mean by a partition executing a transaction? So is it like a stored procedure that you're shipping to these guys?
Or no, it's a, so we're assuming a general transaction model. So you're reading and writing, and then you have a read-write set, and you're trying to commit the transaction using two-phase commit.
So everybody gets all the read-write sets, or you send only the read-write sets?
Yeah, you send only
partition?
Only the read-write sets for a partition. Should I move on to the techniques?
No, because I didn't understand the answer, and the protocol is going to depend on that. So are you running the entire application code of the transaction on every replica?
No, we're actually, all of the applications are running on the storage clients. They're web servers.
So you're sending reads and writes and then getting data?
You're sending reads. You're buffering writes. The model is identical to Spanner. You're sending reads. You're buffering writes. Then when the application calls commit, you start your two-phase commit protocol. You send the read-write set in the prepare. The partitions return an answer. I mean, the replicas in a partition return an answer. IR will return an answer.
So client is the coordinator?
The client is the coordinator.
Okay.
And what does it mean to get a different answer? I mean, the client is providing the writes, and it's sending it to the storage partitions. And then you said that it's
so
looking, and then the client is looking at the results, and if they differ, why would they differ? You're sending the same writes to all the replicas?
Because some of the replicas might have a transaction that conflicts, and some of the other replicas might not have that transaction.
So you might get back a conflict alert, not that you would get back a different result from the updates.
No, not a different result from the preparer. Because the operations going through IR are prepare and commit, not read, write, not.
Keep going. I'm lost. I don't understand.
So a validation fails in the client?
The validation happens at the servers. OCC validation happens at the servers.
At the servers.
So you say prepare. So this is also identical to the Spanner protocol. You say prepare, and the prepare operation is the operation that's replicated. And the prepare for each partition contains just the read and write set for the data that's in that partition. So you say prepare here, and it's replicated through IR to the replicas, and then you get an answer back for your prepare. And then you, depending on what that answer is, if everybody says okay,
so
prepare okay, then you can commit.
What is inside that answer?
It's prepare okay or abort. That's
okay.
It. Yeah. Okay. The way that, some of the transactions change color, it might be a little hard to see. I added these slides so everybody could get the details because my talk's going to run very long now. Taper uses OCC, and the way OCC works is it checks one transaction against every other previously committed or prepared transaction for conflicts. And so this is still okay to run with IR because if we send the transactions to at least a majority, you can see that none of the replicas here actually have all of the transactions, but any conflict between these three transactions will be detected. Okay. So the other problem that we have is that replicas can receive transactions in different orders. And the way we deal with that is we use loosely synchronized clocks at the clients. And this is just an optimization. Because what it means is if we attach a timestamp to the transactions before we send it, some of the replicas can receive transactions out of order and still commit them, right? As long as they don't conflict, the replicas will still agree to the same transaction ordering because they've been tagged with timestamps. Okay. And then the last thing is we multi-version all of our replicas, all of our storage. And so the reason we do this is that one of the replicas might just miss a transaction altogether. It might not see it at all. And so later, we run a synchronization protocol that's periodic across all of the replicas. And that means that the other replica will get the transaction later, and it'll just insert those versions where they're supposed to go. And all of the replicas will still converge to the same state, despite the fact that they didn't process all of the operations in the same in the same order. Okay, so this is very hard to understand. Taper is a complicated protocol because it's using a replication protocol with extremely weak guarantees. And we used these techniques to make that easier, but you probably have to read the paper possibly a couple of times to figure out exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. The goal here is to sort of reduce overhead of doing consistency twice, like once in the replication and then once per transaction. So if all of my transactions access only one object, then this is essentially a replication mechanism.
Quote over replication,
yeah. Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would
yeah,
it,
I mean,
would
that's
it be
true.
Equivalent to an existing mechanism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true in general, yeah. If your transactions only have one.
So is your algorithm in that case, like if I only ever access one object at a time, are you still faster than a standard replication mechanism? Or
yes, because you would still, because the replication mechanism you would use to get strong guarantees would still be go to a leader, then replicate, then come back.
So in that case, this is also a better consensus mechanism?
I mean, yeah, you could think of it that way. So one of the other things we built on top of IR was actually a lock server, and it's a more efficient consensus mechanism for a lock server. The problem is if you need total ordering, it's less efficient. If you have a lot of if you need total ordering and you have a lot of contention. So in particular, if your reads and writes in your transactions that only have one read, one object, right? If each partition only had like one object, then you just want total ordering, right? What we're sort of gaming the system to do is that most partitions have lots of objects, and most of the reads and writes or the transactions, they don't conflict. And so if there was a conflict, Taper would perform worse because it's more optimistic rather than having everyone go to a leader and have the leader just sort everything out and then replicate it. It's actually interesting, though, if you... what I would say is that when you get to extremely high contentions, Taper does not perform well. So there's actually a paper in OSDI this year called Janus, which took the Taper idea of IR and, you know, eliminating the consistency in the lower level, and doing that with transaction chopping instead. And their system actually works better for high contention, because essentially the transactions are scheduled deterministically a priori before running them, and so that means that you get much better performance when the contention is high. Yeah. So let's take a look at some performance results, and then I can wrap up. So we built Taper in a transactional key value store, and we used two benchmarks. We used our retwist benchmark from before. We also used YCSBT, which is a transactional version of the popular Yahoo Cloud Service benchmark. And then we ran our experiments on Google Compute Engine. And we just used their default clock synchronization. It was sufficient for our needs. We don't depend on it for correctness. And so we didn't need any special hardware at all. So we implemented, as a comparison, two concurrency control mechanisms, OCC, optimistic concurrency control, and strict two-phase locking, with two-phase commit on top of view stamp replication, and put those into a key value store. And so this graph is showing throughput in retwist transactions per second across the bottom, and then the latency at a given throughput across the y-axis. So what we can see from this graph is that at low latency, at low throughput, Taper is able to commit transactions in 50% of the time of existing systems, and that Taper is able to achieve a much higher peak throughput because we don't have the leader that's processing essentially 2x the number of messages of all the replicas. So for each transaction, the replicas just process one message to prepare and one to commit. Okay. But I started this section by talking about how programmers had to make a hard choice between distributed transactions, which are easier to use, and performance. And we don't want them to do that. And so, you know, you're saying, okay, this is great. Like, you've made distributed transactions cheaper, but can't I just use something really web scale, like MongoDB, to get 100 times the performance? Well, so what we did was we ran YCSBT and compared Taper against a couple of popular cloud storage systems that are weakly consistent. So no transactions, no consistency. Taper actually performs better than MongoDB. It performs a little bit worse than Cassandra, and then it gives you about half the throughput of Redis. And so, you know, Taper is competitive with these weak consistency systems, even though it's providing linearizable transaction ordering, very strong isolation and consistency, and these other systems are providing neither. The other thing that's really great is that Taper has the same or better latency than all of these systems. And so, you know, I think Taper is a really good first step towards making it so that programmers don't have to pick between something that's easier to use and something that gives you better performance. So now I've talked about the three challenges that programmers are facing in mobile cloud applications, and I'll talk a bit about future work. So what's interesting in this talk is that I talked about things that run directly, largely run directly under the mobile cloud application, these end user applications. But there's actually a lot of stuff going on underneath, some of which I've done work on. And I think looking forward, what the interesting problems are they're here and they're here. You know, they're at the intersection of these systems, of these layers. And the reason for that is that when you look at the average operating system that's running on a cloud server or mobile device, what they're actually running is not a single end user application, but actually something that's a piece of a very large distributed system. Like, even, you know, if you're running Twitter, it's actually your application client that is running in that mobile OS process is a very, very small piece of a really big, complicated system. And so what that means is it raises some interesting new questions for operating systems design. You know, in particular, what kinds of services would be useful to those platforms that are running mobile cloud applications like Diamond and Sapphire? If we were running systems only like Taper on top of our cloud operating systems, should we change the policies? For example, should we be gang scheduling all of the processes across replicas and partitions that are involved in a single transaction? That would get us better performance. And then finally, we need to take a look at abstractions that have been classic operating system abstractions since the beginning of time and ask ourselves whether those things are still useful or whether they're just a barrier to what applications really want to do. So in summary, we should really be redesigning our operating systems around distributed systems. I mean, you know, we didn't design our operating systems initially to do these kinds of things, and I think having looked at and worked on a lot of distributed systems in the past couple of years, I think we really need to. Looking even further out, so that was sort of, you know, stuff I want to work on soon, but looking even further out, we have lots of new devices. I mean, there are new devices popping up every day. My house is somehow full of all of these devices that I don't know how to use. I don't think the killer application for these things is quite there yet. I don't think there's something that these devices can do that my mom would really, really want to, you know, install in her house. But I think, you know, in the next couple of years, we're going to see those killer applications show up, and they're going to need systems. They're probably going to have a completely different set of application problems that we didn't anticipate at all. And so I'm really excited to keep working on this kind of stuff because the world is changing a lot. So to wrap up, I like to design systems. I like to design systems that help programmers, and somehow my computer just decided to stop. Okay. Oh, this screen turned off. That was very strange. I put my systems up online if you're interested. So that's it. Yeah. Thanks.
So Sapphire is essentially a developer framework, right? Have any developers used it? Have you guys given it to any third-party developers? It's already a couple of years old, right? So What is the feedback that you got from them? Did it really make it easy to program?
Yeah. So no, our prototype is not anywhere near ready for people to use. What we have done is, so all of this work basically is being funded by Google. We go and talk to them once a year at least, possibly more. So Mike Dahlin and Matt Welsh are basically the people in charge of our grant. And we keep going and giving them these presentations, and then they disappear and don't tell us anything. So I don't know what's going on. We had some group that came from Google that flew up just to talk to us from California, and they were working on a mysterious project called Turquoise. But they were very, very interested in Sapphire, possibly just because of the name. I don't, but they literally flew up, talked to us for 2 hours, went back to the airport and left. And so I honestly have no idea. We have not given Sapphire to anyone to use. I have talked to the CockroachDB people quite extensively about Taper. They're very interested. There are a couple of other people that are interested in working on Taper. Or using it for various things. Diamond is sort of new, but I've actually been talking to a mobile game company here in Seattle that has really interesting problems. And I think they would really like to use Diamond. I'm not sure if, so they'll use all Amazon services. And so that kind of ties them into certain things. But yeah, I'm talking to them about it.
Mm-hmm. Other areas of work you've done and how they tie to Tapir. So one of the reasons why you would choose Quorum or not go in the favor of primary backup is because of tail latencies.
Mm-hmm.
You have high tail latencies. And some of the other work that you've done, things like Arrakis and other systems which are proposing to remove software from the critical path,
mm-hmm.
one of the things they help you do is reduce these tail latencies.
Yep.
Right? So in the line of that work, do you think you would go back and design Tapir a different way? Maybe not use Quorum Max, or maybe not ship transactions to everyone as opposed to just doing data replication. How would those things affect? Because one of the reasons why you chose to do send the transaction to everyone as opposed to making one of them execute and do the data, send the data, is because of tail latency, suppression of data, and also Quorum Max.
Mm-hmm.
So you have RDMA, you have non-volatile memory, you can access remote storage without even the software being involved,
mm-hmm.
the CPU being. Your Arrakis work also does that. So how do you think that ties with Tapir?
So I think one of the things about Tapir is, it's trying to reduce latencies. And so where it shines is maybe not necessarily in a data center environment where you can control things like how much, what RDMA you have, what technologies you have. But sort of the nice thing about Tapir is you can pick it up, deploy it on Google Compute Engine, and it will reduce the latency of your transactions, and it doesn't need anything special. I think the way to think about it is there are better things you could do, but they require more work, more control. Tapir is a step towards making just general purpose distributed transactions cheaper.
Question about Tapir. What's the data model? Is it a simple key value store?
Yeah, it's a key value store.
When you've talked about guarantees and ensuring things here and there, what do you do in your software to make those guarantees? I mean, do you do proof? Do you do rely on testing? Do you
Tapir has a TLA plus, it's been model checked. But the other systems I don't know that the implementation of Diamond is necessarily 100% correct. We have tests. We have a test framework for testing, our view stamp replication protocol, but it's not verified or anything like that. Yeah.
All right. Let's thank Irene.